prior to that announcement, we were listening to Flashpoints. The speaker was Vijay Prashad, editor of Letters to Palestine, Writers Respond to War and Occupation. And we have one more announcement to play for you before we get to the dirt bag for today. Today, Glenn's guests are Bill Catherall and Tim Vessels. It's the fourth annual beekeeping edition of the Dirt Bag. If you have a bee-related question, call in. You can get that answered. Thank you so much, KBOO members, for your generous support during our recent mini membership drive. It's not too late to become a member or increase your current membership and have it doubled. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO today. Stay tuned for the Dirt Bag.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Stomp, an evening of unamplified performances by some of the region's root music acts, playing the third Saturday of each month, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the December 19th show features Crow Quill Night Owls, Caleb Plotter and Reeve Wilms, and Miller and Saucer, and hosted by country blues yodeler Zach Bryson. Again, that's the Clinton Street Stomp, Saturday, December 19th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by One Green World, a local nursery offering hard-to-find fruiting plants designed to help you grow your own food and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. To order plants or their 2015 color catalog, their website is onegreenworld.com, or you can reach them by phone at 1-877-353-4208.
Well, good morning. We've reached the second Wednesday of the month at 11 o'clock. Golly, it's time for the dirt bag. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. Here with me in the studio is my buddy, Tim Wessels. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Glenn. How are you doing?
We've had four of these, I think, and you've been on every time, I believe.
I certainly hope so.
Okay, and also on the line, we have El Presidente of El Portland. How do you say that in Spanish?
Portland?
Yeah, Portland. Urban Beekeepers.
I'm not sure.
Well, anyway,
Portland Urban Beekeepers.
Yeah, Portland Urban Beekeepers President, Bill Catherall. Good morning, Bill.
Hi, Glenn. Good morning.
Tim's here with us, too, so we'll have a little chat here.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, Bill.
Bill is the current president of the Portland Urban Beekeepers. Tim is the president emeritus, or is that? I don't know,
outgoing.
Outgoing president or ex-president of the Portland Urban Beekeepers. And we'll talk with Bill about that organization, how you can become involved. Also, if you are already keeping bees or want to learn how to keep bees, about the Bee School, the second annual Portland Urban Beekeepers Bee School. Kind of an all-day affair covering all aspects of beekeeping. We'll talk about that. Also, we have our plant of the month is actually favorite plant, bee plants, honeybee plants of winter time. Now, I've covered some of these in the past, but I have some other gems for you in my list here. We also have a bee-related garden stumper, bee stumper. So stay tuned for that. There, of course, is no prize for that. Just bragging rights. Or how fast you can search the internet. So let's start with Bill. Bill, you've been keeping bees what now? 4, 5, 6 years, 7?
About 3 years, a little over 3 years now.
See how fast you can move up in the beekeeping world if you're if you're dedicated and involved. And most people, when they get in, start keeping bees, they become involved. So Bill has gone from novice to president of Portland Urban Beekeepers in just 3 years. And Tim was even less than that. About 2 years or 1 year or something like that. So
yeah, lots of opportunity to get involved.
That's right. Well, give us a background or just give us a synopsis of what Portland Urban Beekeepers is and maybe how it differs from other beekeeping organizations in the metro area.
Well, Portland Urban Beekeepers is a nonprofit group where we help to support bees and beekeepers in Portland. And one of our focuses is on education. And we have monthly meetings where we get together and socialize and talk about bees, share stories, and usually have some guest speaker share a topic that helps to educate beekeepers and get everybody familiar with some of the problems and fixes of how to be a better beekeeper. One of the differences that this club has is we have such a wide variety of different styles of beekeeping, and we have many members who have different types of hives. So we support not just the typical Langstroth hive that you would see in most commercial beekeeper operations, but also more of the top bar and Waray style hives that many backyard beekeepers in Portland tend to favor.
And these monthly meetings are held in Portland, new location. I attend the meetings regularly, yeah. Somewhat regularly there on Alberta.
Yeah, we meet at Alberta Abbey.
Of course, the organization is open to anybody, and the meetings are actually open too. Once you come once or twice, you'll probably want to join the Portland Urban Beekeepers because there are lots of perks to being in the Portland Urban Beekeepers. Oh, I don't know about lots of perks, but one main perk is the opportunity for free bees.
Yeah.
I guess that's one way to look at it.
Our meetings are open to the public and free to join in and attend. But as you said, yeah, it's probably a good idea to join. And our membership costs $25 per person or $40 per family. And that cost helps to support the club and the things that we do. It's not cheap to do the things that we do, and we do need money to do that. But one of the perks is that you can get on our swarm list. And we're using this incredible swarm hotline that's offered through Bee Allies, where we have our own phone number that people can call into, and it's an automated system. So when someone finds a swarm, they can call into the hotline, and it will direct the swarm to the nearest beekeeper, and the beekeeper can contact the person who found the swarm and go out and get the bees. And that's a great way to collect bees, get free bees.
And the only way you can get on that list is to be a member. Or that's right. I shouldn't say it that way. It's just that service is available to members of Portland Urban Beekeepers.
Yeah, Bee Ally, anybody can get on the Bee Allies list, but our specific hotline number that services Portland requires membership in the club.
Uh-huh. Good, good. Okay, so tell us now about the bee school that's coming up.
Yeah, so on February 6th, we'll be having a 6-hour bee school, and that's going to be held at the Urban Farm Store. And they have a new location, too. They're now on 1108 Southeast 9th Avenue. We'll be meeting from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and we're going to have beekeepers and mentors from our club teaching about how to get started with beekeeping. Registration is $40 per person, and that is really the best deal in the area. many other classes are available, but probably cost about the same but are shorter. And with this class, you'll get 6 hours of classroom instruction. Plus, in May, we'll have a field day at our apiary at Zenger Farm, where you can come out for a couple hours, get some hands-on time in the beehives.
Which is invaluable for newbies.
Right. Sitting in a classroom and reading books is great information, but the real learning happens when you start getting in with the bees.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And always cognizant that these are wild animals that could sting me at any time.
Yeah.
They don't, but they could. Okay, so that's the Bee School, from sponsored by the Portland Urban Beekeepers Group.
Yes. You can register on our website, portlandurbanbeekeepers.org. There's a link in the menu at the top called Bee School. Click on that, and you can register there.
It's a fine website, too. And I think a lot of that goes to you, isn't it, Bill?
I have been most of the back end building this thing, but a lot of contributions from other members as well.
Sure. It just works. It just works well. I've been pleased with that. And the meetings, the monthly meetings, are, did we talk about that, when and where?
The first Wednesday of every month at Alberta Abbey. So our next meeting will be January 6th at 7 p.m. at Alberta Abbey.
And that's around what would be second in Alberta, something like that? Or?
Yeah, it's 126 Northeast Alberta Street.
126. Okay. Between first and second there.
Yeah.
All right. That's the Portland Urban Beekeepers. Anything else, Bill?
No. I think that's it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to tell us about that organization, that fine organization.
Hey, you're welcome.
And may you and your bees survive this wet weather.
Yeah, it's a little crazy out there.
Yeah, I've seen pictures in the National Bee magazines about floods and other natural disasters, and it's just heartbreaking to see hives floating down, you know, torrents of water, you know, rivers and or hurricanes or whatnot, but hopefully none of ours will have that fate.
I think I checked on a couple of our apiaries this morning, Glenn, and I thought, oh, I better go see if it's pretty wet down there. And sure enough, there was water everywhere, but fortunately our hives were high and dry. And
well, that's one thing we learn in beekeeping, and is that get them off the ground.
Yeah.
You know, not just for water, but for ventilation and things like that.
Yeah.
So, okay, Bill, thanks again.
All right, thank you.
We'll see you soon.
See you, Bill.
All right.
Okay, let's take a first one of our targeted musical selections here. This all has to do with tight. And the reason for that is because when it gets cold, bees form a cluster. And the colder it gets to a degree, the tighter that cluster gets. Honeybees don't hibernate, so in these past few days when it's been so warm and during when it's not raining, the bees are out. They're looking for things to forage on. And that'll be one of our topics here coming up on our winter our bee plants. So all of my songs this time have been chosen with that in mind. But first, the first one is the 1968 or something like that. Archie Bell and the Drells. The Dells. Archie Bell and the Dells. Is it Dells or Drells? Drells. Drells, yes. Tighten Up. Let's do the Tighten Up.
Just started a new dance.
dance just as good as we want. Which, so in my case, isn't very good. But Archie Bell and the Drells, yeah, from Houston, Texas. We've got a new thing. All right, let's go to the phones. We have a bee question. We're up for it.
Hello?
You're with the Dirtbag.
I raised bees in the early 70s, and I lived in Milwaukee, and got down to 0 degrees for the only time I ever heard of that.
Now, this is Milwaukee, lifetime. Wisconsin?
No, Oregon.
Okay.
And my bees froze, I thought, I should have put insulation or something. Didn't even think that might happen. But there was a nunnery or a abbey or something like that in Silverton, Oregon, where they had a room on the place, and they had all their beehives inside the room and a place for them to fly outside and come in and everything, and they probably never had a problem like that. Well, what would you do with just a regular hive to, keep it from freezing like that?
Well, the rule of thumb is that cold doesn't kill bees, wet does. And if you have a hive that is otherwise healthy and has the requisite number of bees, of course, that's not always a given. In fact, now it's not. But in the 70s, it might have been better because there weren't the varroa mites to deal with.
Right. I didn't have that problem.
So if you have enough bees, then they can really generate enough heat from the to stay warm. But they have to have enough bees. That's the key in this cluster that Archie Bell and the Drells are talking about, talking about tightening up, and they just cluster and they generate heat by contracting their wing muscles. They shiver essentially to generate heat. So generally our recommendation is keep your bees dry, and around here with 0 degrees is an anomaly, and normally our temperatures don't get much below 20. 15 or below is rare.
Not lately.
Right. And so we generally don't recommend anything as far as besides keeping your bees dry. People will wrap their bees with tar paper and other things and insulate them in some very colder climes. But now you introduce situations that are not necessarily natural for the bees, in that they might stay warmer than they would normally, and so they think they can fly. And bees don't eliminate inside the colony, as you know.
Yeah.
And so they hold it until they can fly, so they have enough time, or it's warm enough, so they can go out and eliminate. Well, they think, kept it, if this, 50 degrees, we'll say. Well, they could fly at all times at 50 degrees, mm-hmm. So even though the temperature might be 25 outside. So they fly out there and, woo! Yeah,
they bite the dust.
Yeah, it just means it may be too cold and they can't make it back.
Dang.
So that's why we just really don't recommend taking extraordinary measures except to keep the hive dry. So what we tend to do is to cover our hives with a piece of plywood or just anything to make sure that the water doesn't get in there.
Right, yeah.
Glenn, I might add to that we, as you say, we keep them a ways off the ground also because mm-hmm. there is evaporative moisture that can come up through the bottom boards. And so, not having them right next to the ground or even a few inches, but, at least a foot to 18 inches is kind of where we try. And I think about how cold it gets here, and I think about the top two honey producing states, or in the top five for sure. Yeah. It's like North Dakota and Minnesota or something. It gets a heck of a lot colder there.
Yeah, even Montana does more than Oregon does, I think.
Yeah, and the majority of those beekeepers, the large apiaries, they don't wrap or do anything.
Well, they, and I don't know, but some of them may move their bees away from there for the winter. Take them to,
Florida.
Yeah.
Well, apropos the flying and freezing and everything are on the outside if it's too cold. This place in Silverton seemed to be pretty successful, and I don't even know if it's still there. I hadn't been there in years and years, but have you ever been there?
Well, it might be the Mount Angel Abbey.
Yeah, that was it.
And I haven't heard about having them bees.
Yeah, they had a whole room kind of off on the end of the place.
In Europe, You know, every country has their ways of keeping bees, and every person has their way of keeping bees. And they're all good. You know, if they work, then they're good.
Yeah.
As the Duke of Ellington said, you know, if it sounds good, it is good. You know, and if those bees survive, then so be it. Every year we, the Portland Urban Beekeepers, I shouldn't say we, but Portland Urban Beekeepers, along with our, you know, major advisor, Dr. Dewey Karen, will puts out a survey in the early spring to survey the results of, or the survival.
Feedback.
Yeah, and so we get ideas on what backyard beekeepers are doing and how that affects survival.
Wow, that sounds cool. Hey, well, thanks a lot for the program.
You bet. Thanks for the call. Okay, we'll move in. My guest, Tim Wessels, here. He is very involved with various beekeeping events around the state. And before we talk about the Oregon State Master Beekeepers Program, of which Tim is now in the middle level of that, the journeyman level, I'd like Tim to talk about the OSU Honeybee Lab and let people know that OSU now has, well, they have now for, what, 4 or 5 years, again, has a honeybee presence in the state doing research on not necessarily are all just honeybees, but honeybee nutrition and disease and other things like that. And Tim has, along with Bridgetown Bees, has a project they're working on with. So tell us about the Honeybee Lab.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Well, first of all, I think we were pretty fortunate to have, it's in my mind, a world-class lab down there at OSU, and that's headed by Dr. Ramesh Sagili. And their studies have almost entirely been based on, which is, I think, interesting, and I've always considered nutrition a big part of what I do for myself and my family, but their studies are about honeybee nutrition for the most part, and what the bees need and the varying nutrients and from the proteins and the pollens to the nectars. And so one program that they're working on right now, in fact, some of the folks from the bee lab are down in the almonds right now working in a project called APSM, where it's funded by the Almond Board to sample bees and track forage data. And so what they're doing, and you got to keep in mind that the almonds down there have 875 plus thousand acres of nothing but almonds. And so for pollination, you need about 1.7 million hives to pollinate those almonds. And that's just incredible. And so leading up to the pollination and then after the leading up to the flowering of the almonds, there's basically nothing for those bees to eat. And so what they're doing right now is they're planting mustard and brassicas, and I don't know what all other plants that might involve, but they're planting rows and strips of these in one area. Then they're checking the nutrition of those bees that have that available to them prior to the bloom and after the bloom. And then they've got a control group that's in the middle of the 875,000 acres somewhere where they have nothing but almonds. And then they're, fed sugar syrup until the bloom comes in to a certain percentage.
And I'll just provide a little background here in that, you know, I'm sure our listeners, our dirtbag listeners, have heard about, you know, monocultures for growing crops and whatnot. If all you have is, corn, then, you know, pests and diseases can take hold in that because we want various things to attract beneficial insects and whatnot. When we talk about monoculture of almonds and bees, it's that bees are only getting, if they're in the middle of these 875,000 acres or so, they're only getting almond nectar and pollen. And while that in itself is an excellent pollen, because not all nectars are created equal, what we want is a varied diet, just like us.
Yeah.
You know, that works well for us. So that's what this study might show, is that these bees do better. We hope maybe it shows that.
Yeah, it's how the supplemental foraging affects the bees. And so, you know, rather than just say, I think it would be better, then they're tracking the data and seeing the survivorship of these hives that are in the area where they're, you know, given these these other plants to forage on. And then and that ties into a lot of the studies they do, some right here in Oregon. We have one program that we're doing with them in collaboration with the Port of Portland, and we're by, and Glenn and I are with our queen breeding
project
with Bridgetown Bees. We have two large apiaries that are on multiple acres, you know, a total of a couple of hundred acres, and we're looking at expanding forage. These are just huge fields of weeds, and I think there's a couple of things that we, Glenn and I, have identified, like Canada thistle, and I think there might be teasel or something in there, but mostly just as far as the bees go, it might as well be asphalt. And so they're ripping up much of this acreage and planting seeds of a variety of seeds, of which we had some input on. I think, Glenn, you gave them some input on some of our favorite plants. And then we'll go back, and since we have bees in these locations, we're able to pull pollen from them, just a small amount of pollen that they've collected, and we send that down to the bee lab. And then the folks down there will analyze the protein content and percentage and give us that information, which we'll feed back to the Port of Portland for additional support and maybe expanding to all the acreage being covered with nothing but forage for bees and other pollinators.
The plant list that we've seen that they've planted so far are all native plants, mm-hmm. Or seeds anyway.
Yeah.
So that will support native pollinators as well as honeybees. But it's, you know, the reason that honeybees are kind of nice is because they bring back the pollen to where you know they bring it back to.
Right. It's kind of the canary in the coal mine. I mean, if you have managed bees, you can then use them to tell you what's going on. And, you know, if what we see with what they're bringing back could easily be, you know, what the other pollinators, the bumbles and other bees that are collecting pollen.
Yeah.
You know, one other thing that kind of ties in with this that I think is really cool, Dr. Sagili just brought this to my attention, but last week there was a national transportation bill passed that includes planting forage. Congressman Peter DeFazio was the lead negotiator on that bill, and he has said that we've got a really interesting little provision in there that helps pollinators to allow states to use federal money to plant pollinated plants for bees and creating these sorts of migration routes. And we have, apparently, it looks like Oregon itself will receive more than $2.6 billion to fund rebuilding and replacing the highways and bridges. But some of that money will go to planting these areas of forage along these highways and rail.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's really
great. We hear about wildlife corridors. You know, we like, you know, elk to be able to come all the way to Forest Hills from the coast.
From the coast, yeah.
You know, have these unbroken ways. And, you know, it's the same with pollinators.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, we've got another phone call. Good morning, Dan. You're with the Dirtbags Beekeeping Edition.
Good morning, Dirtbags.
Go ahead.
So I'm reading this book about herbal antivirals by Stephen Buhner.
Okay. Not familiar with it.
Extolling the medicinal properties of honey.
Excellent.
He says honey that's augmented, or bees that are fed sugar supplements don't have the medicinal qualities that wildflower honey does.
Yeah, I can believe that. The likelihood is that you're not going to get much honey, if you will, if you're feeding your bees syrup. Generally, let's just talk a little bit about, you know, feeding. And you know, I think all beekeepers, I shouldn't say all because that's not going to happen. Most beekeepers are not going to let their bees starve to death.
Right.
Just like you wouldn't let, you know, your goats, you know, well, go out there and forage, and if you run out of forage, well, that's too bad. You know, you die. And sometimes bees, for whatever reason, they've swarmed late in the season, so they have fewer numbers and they don't have or they haven't been able to build up the amount of honey reserves that they need to get them through the winter. You know, we just got to feed them. You got to feed them something. And, you know, you could feed them honey, which is expensive way to do it. If it's your own honey, that's okay. If you're buying honey, you always run the risk of introducing diseases that can be, one disease really, I think, that can be in honey. And so typically what beekeepers do is we'll make a syrup out of sucrose, white sugar. This is backyard beekeepers. And even more commercial beekeepers are going just to sucrose and away from the high fructose corn syrup. And it's just an emergency feed. At least that's the way we look at it here, too. So I understand that there's not the nutrients from, you know, cane sugar that there is from the nectar from a wide variety of flowers. So sorry to usurp you there. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, no, I just wanted to bring up that reference, Stephen Buhner talking about herbal antivirals. And one of the things that he points out is there's things that happen to pollen in the bee's stomach that produces compounds, many of which they haven't even described yet.
I can believe that, too.
Yeah,
they've been using honey as a wound dressing in England for years. We just finally woke up to the fact that we have a powerful herbal healing substance. So that's the fact of the day, Stephen Buhner, herbal.
Please make a note of it.
Right.
Great.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Dan. Well, that's a good point. And I mean, just good points that, as I mentioned earlier, not all nectars and pollens are created equal. Okay.
I 10 seconds here, I just wanted to add one more thing that the Honeybee Lab will do for anyone in the state of Oregon, or actually probably outside of the state. But for us in the urban areas, you can send your bees, samples of your bees, down to the Honeybee Lab at OSU, and they will gladly do diagnostics on those and determine what kind of diseases there may be having, you might be dealing with. And so I think that's a great benefit that you can get from the Honeybee Lab.
And another benefit for joining the Portland Urban Beekeepers is that you'll get instruction and direction on how to collect bees.
Correct.
You know, get a correct sampling of bees to send to the lab. It's a good point.
Great,
okay,
great,
so that's the OSU Bee Lab, and after our break here, we'll come back and talk about the OSU Master Beekeeper Program, which is unique in these United States, and we'll also talk about the queen breeding program then too. So let's go to our next musical break. This is the title of the album from Climax Blues Band, is called Tightly Knit. But this is an old Willie Dixon tune from, 1971, Spoonful, Climax Blues Band.
Oh,
spoonful. He doesn't say a spoonful. It could have been a spoonful of honey.
I'm sure that's what he was singing about. <You're right.
laughs> All right, that's Climax Blues Band. Okay, it's almost, it's past half past the hour, so it's time for the Garden Stumper, although this is the Honeybee Stumper. Let's do it. Okay, this could be a two-parter, but we'll take any part of it. I haven't even run this one by Tim, so he's going to have to guess, too.
Oh, man.
Okay, so the first part is, how long have honeybees been producing honey from flowering plants? And the other part, part B, for extra credit, would be, how long have honeybees been producing honey in the United States? Okay, so if you know the answer to that, 503-231-8187. That's also the same number to call if you have a bee-related question this time. 503-231-8187. All right. Okay, Tim, topic number two here has to do with the Oregon Master Beekeeper Program.
Yeah, this is a unique program, as you said, Glenn, because of a couple of things. But one of them is that first of all, let me describe a little bit about the program. It's a little different than the Master Gardeners program in that this is about a 4-year program minimum. And it's, you know, there's various levels as there, I don't know if there is in the garden.
No. and with the... Yeah, go ahead.
But you know, one of the things I think that is...
There's kind of three levels of this, so you can...
Yeah.
You don't have to, you know, become a...
An expert.
Right. you can stop after your first year.
Yeah, and that's absolutely fine. I mean, you can, you know, some people just want to get a little bit more information, and it's pretty thorough. There's, I think the really unique part of this is that it, you know, besides all the hands-on training and the classes and the experience that you get, but you are provided a mentor. Each person that signs up for the program gets a mentor, and then that way you have the hands-on, which you and Bill were talking about is so important, the hands-on training with the bees in the hive, working with bees several times during this course of the beekeeping season.
And there are other master beekeeper programs, state master beekeeper programs, but what makes this one unique is that this is the only one that pairs
you up
everybody with a mentor.
Correct. Right. And sometimes the scheduling of that becomes a little bit difficult. You know, just it does require a little bit of coordination. You know, for both you and I are mentors, I believe, Glenn, this year, and it's enjoyable. It's a lot of fun. This year they have a new element that they're adding to it, which I think is really cool. That they're going to have an ODA pesticide investigators, and they'll be providing training to extension agents throughout the state that they will be in a position to teach folks about pollination and proper use of pesticides.
Hmm.
And I think this is huge. I mean, and I think this was probably partly in due to some of the bee die-offs or deaths that we've seen from poisonings, we've seen from some of the pesticide misuse that has been sprayed either at a wrong time during a foraging time or when the plants are in bloom. But so that'll be added. That's really good. The 2016 enrollment for since the program has been in effect, I think for 4 years now, I think it's about 4 years, that there's been over 800 students that have entered into the program. And for this year, the Portland area is full, which, you know, stands to reason. We're the largest city, so we tend to fill up a little quicker. And
it's kind of limited by the number of
mentors
here.
Correct. But you can get on there and sign up. You know, Portland area, you can actually get signed up for 2017 by just going to the website. And can I say that, Glenn? Mm-hmm. It's at OregonMasterBeekeeper.org. And all the information is there for you to get signed up. And there's actually quite a bit of information that's available to you, even if you're not signed up yet. So just for answering questions.
And there's a charge yes. for that? Do you know what that is?
I think for the apprentice, I think it's right around $100. Okay. It might be a little more. I know journey level and master level, it's a little more, but all that information is available to you on the website. The other thing is that once you're in the actually get through the apprentice level, the journey level, you get service level points are acquired by teaching in schools and doing presentations and garden clubs and writing articles and bee journals. And
this is for the second level.
The second level, correct. Level.
The apprentice is pretty much focused on beekeeping itself, you know, getting
it's just the basics down. The fundamentals,
right? But
this is really great if you do go on, because now there's a new field force of educated beekeepers that are out there, you know, teaching people in the community about bees and how what you can do to help. And as we talked about earlier, the number one thing, which I think Glenn's going to mention about the plants that are blooming mm-hmm. right now, is plant more forage.
Right.
They need food, and not just in June.
Even if you don't have bees, you know, one of the easiest and most enjoyable things to do is to plant plants that attract bees, and then you can watch them and enjoy them. So, all right, let's take a break here and see if Stephen has the correct answer. Morning, Stephen.
Hello. I just like to thank all the pollinators out there. Those bees are great for me in my garden.
Great, great. Yeah, we depend on them.
Uh-huh.
And how long have we been depending on them?
Well, in North America, we've been depending on them since the Clovis migration 13,000 years ago.
Well, not honeybees, but maybe other bees.
Pollinators.
Yeah, I mean, maybe some other ones have come, but... The point here is that honeybees are not native to North America.
Okay.
Not just in the United States. So that's part of the question there, or that's part of the answer anyway. So, okay, so
I'm way too soon then.
Well, so we're still looking for how long have honeybees been producing honey from flowering plants, just worldwide, and how long in the United States? So
okay.
We're still looking. But that's a good guess.
All right, thank you.
You bet. We can start giving hints if we don't get any, if we come up empty there.
Yeah, I can think of a couple of hints. Maybe one is think tall ships.
Yeah, that would be one. And with the other, I'll give a hint that I'll give you the correct answer if you're within a million years.
Oh,
yeah. So that's narrowing it down here now, isn't it? Right. Okay, so just a little bit more on the Oregon Master Bee Program. So the apprentice is the first, it takes about a year. You've got a year to do that. And when you're paired with a mentor, you meet with the mentor at least once each season.
Yeah, so, at least once. And then on top of that, there's a series of classes, classroom that it takes place in usually in the early part of the year. And I'm one of the instructors for that. And that is generally January, February, March, which is great to be in the classroom because there's not a whole lot going on with the bees. But that series of takes you right through. It's about 8 classes total, and they're 2-hour classes. So then when the bees start to fly, then you're ready to get out there and you kind of have the background to get in the hive and know a little bit more what you're doing.
It's a well thought out and run program.
Oh, it's excellent. Like I said, I think they're unique in that they offer some things that you don't see in some of the other programs around the country. But I think it's, and I haven't really been to the other ones, but I think it's very well run and very useful for new beekeepers.
And then the journey level, just to wrap this up, is a 1, 2, or 3 year program. Just kind of depends on how long you want to do it. And because the program is so new, there are no Oregon certified master beekeepers Oregon master beekeeper program certified master beekeepers.
Yeah, I think that's right.
There are some master beekeepers that have been certified by other organizations that are older, but it takes time.
Yeah, it does. And I think, I've been a journey level for a few years now, but that's because, Glenn, you keep me so busy with the other things we're doing. I don't have time to do my studies.
Right. And I've kept bees for 25 years, and there's just always new stuff to learn.
I mean, it's always something.
So, okay. And then the final topic that I'd like you to address here is the Queen Bee Project, the Bridgetown Bee queen bee project. And I'll just once again say we're looking now for our garden stumper or the beekeeping stumper is how long have honeybees been producing honey from flowering plants worldwide and then how long in the United States? 503-231-8187. Okay, so how's the queen bee?
Well, I think my personal assessment is that we're gradually, incrementally working to a stronger queen bee, which means stronger colonies in the Portland area. And so we're on our fourth winter, fourth winter of where we've been. We started with just some bees that survived the winter, 4 years ago, and we started raising daughters of a queen 4 years ago, the great, 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 great grandmother of this, and then subsequently been raising queens from her daughters since then. And we had a little bit of a downturn in 2 years ago, but last year and this year, I think we're looking much better and a much stronger survivorship, I think, coming into the spring. This year, we're doing a couple of things differently. As you know, we can control the genetics of the queen. So we've got 50% of it that we kind of think, she's strong, she's surviving for whatever reason, she's able to deal with the viruses that are vectored by this parasite called a varroa mite. But the other 50% comes from the male drones that she mates with. So this year we're moving one of our mating yards, which is basically a place that we take all these queens to, and when they're even before they hatch, they're put into these, basically called mating nukes, along with 8 to 10,000 workers, and then when she goes out on a mating flight, she will mate with upwards of 15 to 20 drones on a 1 to 3 day excursion into these drone congregation areas. So we're moving our mating yard to a location that is pretty far from any backyard beekeepers. So we think that will enhance the ability for our queens to mate with bees that are either, there's no true feral bees, I think, anymore, honeybees, but bees that are surviving in the holes of tree trunks and other survivor bees that are within a couple of miles of this location.
So those, pardon me, those bees have not been treated with any type of...
Correct.
Our queens, the Bridgetown bee queens, have not been treated.
No.
They're just on their own.
No, we don't do that, as you know, because then you're kind of giving them an artificial crutch to survive, and that's a slippery slope. I mean, you can start doing that, but just to get them to survive, but then we want them to develop a strength on their own to be able to survive without... all the additional things that you can do to help them.
That's our goal.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got more calls. Sam, good morning, Sam.
So I'm double dipping here.
All right.
I got a question. I got a guess about introduction of bees to North America.
Yep.
I think it happened when the Spaniards came and they brought bees for actually the production of wax to feel in the missions when they produced wine, they needed wax to feel the jug.
Well, that's an excellent guess, but that's not how honeybees ended up in these United States.
All right.
We're going to get this.
Yeah.
Tim, you're looking like you're stunned.
Well, I don't know the exact year, but I'm hoping that somebody guesses it, so I can.
Well, I don't know the exact year either.
It's a series of years, and
yeah. Well, I'll tell you that it was after the Mayflower.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. This is Tammy in the air room. I got a call from Linda, who's driving and couldn't stay on the phone.
Okay.
She guessed the 1600s.
That's a good enough guess.
All right.
Because it's what I say. It's been about 400 years, not quite 400 years. So is that 2015? It might even be a little earlier than that. When did Columbus hear? 1492?
Mm-hmm.
So it was after that. It was after, and when did the Mayflower, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria? But it was. They came from. This is the first or the second half of our question. We'll just answer it here. You know, they came from Europe, where these are European honeybees that are in the United States or that we keep in the United States. There's now Africanized honeybees in the United States, but they came by way of Argentina, and they have been here for less than 25 years. The Africanized honeybee, but they still make honeybees. So that is just very interesting that honeybees are not native to North America, and that kind of gets us beekeepers in trouble sometimes.
It does, but
but then neither are we.
That's I was going to say, are you? I'm not. But speaking of Native Americans, I believe that they actually had a term when they started seeing these honeybees is called a phrase called the white man's fly.
Right.
And I, you know, because they hadn't seen them before, they started coming over.
So that's, all right, that's the part B. And now we're still looking for part A. How long have honeybees been producing honey from flowering plants? That's another question. Yeah. In fact, I'll even give you, if you guessed, within 5 million years. How many years ago? So, all right, well, let's take our last break. And I want to set this one up. This is kind of poignant that the band called Chase, and led by the man Bill Chase, had three albums. And the first song of the first album was called Open Up Wide. And the last song on the last album is called Close Up Tight. It's kind of interesting. And shortly after the third album came out, Bill Chase was killed in an airplane accident. So that was, I don't know what that means. But anyway, this is what bees do when it gets cold. They close up tight too. Bill Chase, he's a trumpet player. So there's going to be some screaming. We're going to go to the Chase tune here, Tammy. And he can play that trumpet. Chase, the band Chase, Close Up Tight. That's from about 1974, 5 or 6, something like that. Bill, the Chase band, their big hit was Get It On. That was their only hit. Okay, well, let's see. We have a phone call. Let's see if we've got an answer. Joseph, do you have the answer for us?
You know, I believe it's 100 million years.
Oh, that's way too long. Sorry. Oh. But you're going in the right direction. It's a lot of years, but not that many. I'm sorry.
No, not since the Cretaceous period.
I don't know all of those eras. I learn them and then I forget them.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. Well, you know, when were these bees found in amber? I mean, that's kind of
that's a
clue here.
Oh,
yeah.
Ah, right. Okay. I'll figure it out.
Okay. Okay. Catherine, you got an idea?
I have a question.
Okay.
Two questions. One is, what plants are good for pollinators?
We're going to get there.
Oh, all right. And then also, can we plant them these days?
You mean now?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay, that leads right in then, Catherine. Thank you for that. We'll talk about some of our favorite winter blooming plants. The winter is a great time to plant plants when the ground can be worked. You know, not when it's freezing and you know, the ground's frozen, but that's not the problem or a problem now. Oftentimes we get the plants are dormant now. Not oftentimes. Most plants are dormant now. And so it's a great time to plant. I just caution you about working your soil when it's too wet. I think it's kind of always okay to take a shovel, take some dirt out, plant your plant, and then gently pack the dirt back around the plant, the root ball. But we don't want you to be out there, you know, trying to get all the clods out and whatnot, because you'll actually make clods when it's too wet. But yes, one can do it. I have a list of some of my favorite plants here. Tim will probably think about some of his. But as I mentioned last week, one of my favorite winter blooming plants is the Mahonias. Not necessarily the Oregon grape Mahonia, but some of their cousins from Asia, China area. The Arthur Menzies, the Sunshine, the Sweet. Cassidy or Chastity or something like that. I can't remember. Those are all related, but they bloom at different times. The Arthur Menzies is blooming right now.
Amazing.
It's just a breath of, it's a good thing for your eyes to see these vivid yellow blooms. Sometimes if it gets very cold below 15 or 20, these blooms will blacken and they'll die out. But that's very rare. So those are the Mahonias. Look for that. These are cousins of Oregon grape. Oregon grapes generally start blooming in March, which I wouldn't consider a winter blooming plant. Otherwise, I would include them on that. Winter honeysuckle is going on right now. It's a vining plant. It also has yellow blooms. It will crawl onto fencing and things like that. It makes a great screen. And when they bloom this time of year, that's a benefit. And the reason that we're talking about these in a beekeeping class or edition here is because they're not, once again, honeybees don't hibernate. So when it's warm enough, they'll be out looking for forage and to eliminate, defecate, if you will. Winter jasmine, another plant that is good. Now, the manzanitas are not blooming now, but they will start in February. Another plant, great plant for that. Also starting in February are the crocuses. And in fact, if you could find crocus bulbs still in the nursery, you can plant those now if the ground is loose enough. Plant them. In fact, I was out doing some neighborhood planting with asters yesterday.
Oh, good idea.
Wink, wink. And also starting in February are flowering currants. That's a native plant, the Ribes sanguineum. And the willows, including pussy willows, will start blooming in February. Those are a great source of pollen. The bees really start picking up go ahead. You can mention those.
Oh, no, I was just wondering which hazel and heather were...
Yeah, they're good, but they're not excellent.
Okay.
Or in my estimation, and they could be, you know, and some of the heaths are...
I just see them blooming. I don't necessarily see bees on them.
Right. I mean, by tradition, they are considered bee plants, but, mm-hmm. you know, maybe there's something else blooming, so they're...
More attractive.
Yeah. Right, so the bees aren't on them there, too, so... as I was saying... The queen is really laying a lot of eggs starting in February. She'll do some in January, but so they need a lot of pollen to feed to those baby bees. And that's why we like pollen plants as well as nectar plants. Okay, the answer to the question, of how long honeybees have been making honey from flowering plants? 10 to 20 million years.
That's a long time.
We need them more than they need us. All right, Tim Wessels, thank you very much.
Thank you, Glenn.
Tammy, outstanding job as usual. This is Glenn Andreessen. We'll be back in, I'm assuming Tammy will be back in January. All right, Jim will be back here alongside me too. On what day is that? Don't have it on my list here. Yes, here it is. January 13th. We've got 5 weeks. Have a great solstice. It's coming up. That's my story so far.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, December 9th, 2015. In local news, a Gresham man who was arrested for filming the police last year has had charges refiled against him. Fred Marlowe was awoken by police activity outside his apartment late one night last year and decided to record the event on his iPad. Police approached him and demanded that he stop. When he kept filming, Marlowe was arrested. The charges against him were dropped, but after he threatened to sue for wrongful arrest and received a settlement from the city of Gresham, the charges against him were refiled.